Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Riding the Storm Out. My good friend and co-pastor and co-heart in crime for many, many years, Dan Fisher. And what is my name? Paul Blair.
Paul Blair.
That's what it is. And
yes.
By the way, I had to show this off.
What is up with this?
One of the members of our congregation, long-time member, for like 15 years, diehard OSU fan.
Yes.
Bless his heart. He was 85, wound up stepping into heaven.
Okay.
So he's about my size. His wife offered me a few of the sport coats. And I went over there and I found this navy blue with the OSU. Not everyone can get away with this. Art Coots, this is in honor of Art Coots. This was his custom made, and he has bequeathed it to me. So this is the first time I've worn it in public after receiving it this last
weekend. How cool is that, man?
Not everybody can get away with this kind of audacity, but well.
Well, it has Oklahoma State on the other side,
absolutely.
Too. Yeah. I don't know if the camera can see that.
Anybody sported a mustache for 30 years and not realizing how bad it looked, I can sport this as well.
No, but here's the deal, man. You earned that.
I can pull this off.
Well, you earned it.
Well, last week we talked about different political systems. I hope you enjoyed that. We talked about, quite frankly, what we have in America, which is not a democracy, but it's a
republic.
That's exactly right. We're a constitutional republic. We're not ruled by the many or the majority. We're supposed to be ruled by law that we constituted.
Yep. Exactly.
We, the people, created a limited civil government, and then we pledged to be bound by the law, not by President whoever or Congress whoever, but by the law and the limited things that we
have. Not even the courts?
Not even the courts.
Ooh.
You know, where did we ever get the idea that courts pass down rulings? You know, there's supposed to be opinions.
Yeah.
But look at how we've become accustomed to saying the Supreme Court ruled.
Yeah.
Well, I guess 200 years of habit, huh?
Well, I guess so. You know, when you get judicial review early on, pretty much those were the seeds of the demise of the republic, in my opinion.
Jefferson even warned of that, didn't he?
No, because he was very leery of the courts. But whenever the court can tell you what something means and you can't read it for yourself, then one of two things is wrong. Either what was written so ambiguously that no one can know what it means, i.e. a lot of our laws today,
right.
Or we'll tell you what it says. Isn't that what the Catholic Church used to tell people?
That's right.
For?
During the Dark Ages. Wonderful period of time called the Dark Ages.
Yeah, don't worry about that. We'll tell you what it means.
You know, the thing that's so baffling about this, Dan, is so many of these passages that they use from the Constitution are not even difficult. I mean, those of us that aren't, experts of the law, but we just know a little bit about history and have a little common sense and critical thinking skills, know what was going on when they penned it, knew exactly what they were talking about. You really can't confuse these things unless you intend to confuse.
Well, and they put modifiers, they put phrases, like, for instance, Congress shall make no law.
Right, right.
Okay, all right, so no law. All right, that means any kind of restriction.
Right. That's right.
All right, the Second Amendment shall not be infringed. Well, we all know what that means, but they have nuanced it to the point that now Biden's out today, President Biden, saying, well, you know, you can't own a bazooka and you can't own a missile launcher, and there's limits to the Second Amendment. You know, I really don't think the framers intended for there to be any limits. Shall not be infringed. So any limit would infringe, wouldn't it?
Amen. Yeah. Well, you remember the night of Paul Revere's ride? Where was Mr. Revere going to?
Yeah, he was going to Lexington to warn the Minutemen there in Lexington.
That's exactly right. Pastor Jonas Clark and those Minutemen in Lexington, they didn't only just have muskets, which were basically the modern-day assault rifle of 1775. But they also had a couple of cannon up there.
Yeah, especially in Concord.
Exactly. Yeah. That's part of their security up in those areas.
That's exactly right.
So as far as President Biden saying, well, you can't be able to own a bazooka, actually, we should be able to.
Yeah, if you're a law-abiding citizen, what are you going to do with it?
Exactly.
Protect yourself.
I could own a Sherman tank and nobody has to worry anything about it because I'm not going to misuse it and violate anybody's rights.
And I understand, Dave and I were talking a while ago, that there is something to be said for the idea of arms in common use. Most of us don't own a nuclear warhead. most of us don't have ICBMs in our backyard, you know. So I realize that
Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
I thought we all did.
And I realize you can get a little bit ridiculous with it. But the point is the framers understood, and they knew because of what we're going to talk about here, that government always wants to consolidate power.
Yep.
Always consolidate. Yep. You know, our good friend Bill Federer talks about how God wants to decentralize power, but how fallen man wants to centralize it into a fist.
Like Nimrod.
Exactly.
Babel.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, this is a perfect
You meant
launch.
Nebuchadnezzar, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I was listening to Glenn Beck the other day. That would make me the worst Bible lesson I ever heard.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't know whether to laugh or cry as I was driving my car. That when Nebuchadnezzar and the Tower of Babel was like, what?
And they were only the elitists that were involved.
God.
The common man wasn't. All that. I didn't read
well,
that.
Well, this conversation, unintended, but perhaps the Lord is just directing it. I think he is. Ties in perfectly with our conversation on economics.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that the founders didn't want, in fact, Israel didn't have for their first 400 years. They didn't have a standing army.
Yeah.
We didn't have a standing army.
Right.
Why?
Because it was the people.
A standing army could be used to tyrannize
no,
their
of
own
course.
People.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So the militia was every able-bodied man.
That is
from
exactly
roughly
right.
15 to 65.
Yep.
Was supposed to, whenever the shofar was blown in biblical times, or the militia was called up in
the second alarm
times.
In Lexington
That's
is
exactly.
when the 77 guys show up to fight, or to at least make a stand.
But in order to go from a free market to one of these other systems, you've got to have a little bit of power of influence. So we're going to talk about four basic economic systems today. And we are going to start first with what we are supposed to have in America, which is a free market.
Yeah.
Daniel, what are some of the characteristics of private property ownership in a free market?
Well, let me first say that I think these economic systems are important when we talk about forms of government because you really can't separate the two.
True.
In the end, one goes without the other.
That's right.
Okay, so this whole argument, the whole debate between the different kinds of economies, in my opinion, is really easy to understand when you understand they're really all about who owns the capital.
Yeah.
And the capital is the ability to make a product and to then sell it for your own wealth or profit. Mm-hmm. And so your capital is your means of production. So a farmer, his capital is a plow horse back in the old days and a plow. Today it's a tractor and a disc and all this kind of stuff. So in a free market, basically the government stays out of the economy, doesn't manipulate it and put its finger on the scales to tip things because it has all of this power like you're talking about and literally is regulated by the free enterprise of individuals who operate legally. We have laws to keep bad guys from doing illegal things, but the individual people own the capital and then they decide how they're going to use it. And with the fruits of their labor, they're able to make a profit, and then that's theirs. Mm-hmm. They own it. Basically, to me, that is as simple as I can make it with a free market.
So basically, in a free market, you can choose to buy this computer.
Yeah, a Mac that doesn't work half the time.
Then you can choose to sell it when it quits working.
Yeah, or drive over it with my truck
or
when I'm really upset at it.
Buy it, sell it, use it however you see fit, as long as it doesn't violate the rights.
Because I own it.
Private
property rights.
That's exactly right.
Exactly right.
Okay. So in the opposite of that extreme, and quite frankly, I think we'll go opposites, and then we'll talk about the nuances.
That's good.
The opposite of private property ownership is state-owned property, which is socialism. That's what socialism
is.
Exactly. We're
going
to talk about fascism, communism. But basically, you've got private property ownership where the government just makes sure that we aren't breaking the rules and lying or stealing from each other or doing anything that's illegal when there are few things they ought to be doing.
Laws of nature, nature's
that's
God.
That's exactly right. And then the individuals in the free market can choose what they're going to build, what they're going to price it at, how many employees they need, what factories they want to use, what color they want to make it, what material they want to use. Free market.
Yeah.
You can choose because you're competing for the market share. Right?
And the law that drives that is the law of supply and demand.
Right.
If people want it and I have it, I can determine what I want to charge for it. If hardly anybody wants it, then I can't charge as much for it. Right. And therefore, if I can't charge enough for it, I'll stop making that and start making something that people want.
And the free market always works well for everyone because there is incentive to provide a better product at a cheaper price.
Of course.
Because you want to sell more of them and gain a larger market share.
And that's called competition.
Competition. Yeah. And consequently, like in 2004, Cindy and I built a house, 2003, 2004, we built a house and I bought one of the first flat screen televisions.
Oh, I remember.
It was a 42-inch Sony plasma.
Ooh.
It was about this thick.
Yeah, and weighed probably a couple hundred pounds.
It was pretty heavy.
Yeah.
You know what that cost? $5,500.
Yeah.
Now you can buy, in fact, they give flat screen 42 inches away. When you buy a 70 inch or a 75 inch, we'll throw in a 40 inch flat screen. And they're like paper thin.
Yeah.
Why is that?
LED, invention, innovation.
Exactly.
Competition.
Market competition.
Yeah.
And we all benefit from it because we have better, more access to better products and they become affordable. So it's not just the rich being able to enjoy chocolate. It's Mr. Hershey creating a chocolate bar that everybody can afford and everybody has.
So someone was telling me a few months ago that one of the perfect examples of pure free market is found in LASIK surgery.
Yeah.
Because insurance doesn't pay for that.
Yeah.
And so there's no government intervention. Yeah. And when LASIK surgery first came out, it was very expensive. But because it's based upon just what you can afford in your pocket, what have they done to the price of that? Whoa.
Everybody
all
can
the
afford
way down.
It now.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was like $3,000 to $5,000 per eye at one time.
Oh yeah.
And now it's very affordable.
Yeah.
Here's another example. Everybody owns
good
one
grief.
Of these.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's free market. The opposite of that is where the state owns everything. Now, if the state owns everything, then that means you own
nothing. And you'll like it.
And you'll like it. As a matter of fact, the most basic of private property is your own
body.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the state actually in these we call them communist nations, but they have socialism established, so they own everything. The state owns all the buildings, the state owns all the machinery, the state owns the labor and the production of labor.
Yeah.
And you're the labor.
And the profits.
That's exactly
right. They determine what you'll get.
Yep. And they determine what you'll do.
Right. And so is there any incentive to excel because the government's going to determine what you make? So what do people do?
They quit working hard.
Shoddy work, laziness.
Yep,
that's
there's
exactly
no reward.
Right.
Why work long hours? Why excel when you cannot be rewarded for your labor?
You make the same as the guy who doesn't do anything.
Why go to medical school and spend all those many years studying when you could just get a basic education in women's studies and earn the same living?
Yeah.
No reason to sacrifice.
So when we were discussing before we started the podcast here, you were talking about the pilgrims and how they experimented with this whole concept. And by the way, let me also say something that we were talking about. You know, we often talk about communism. Well, communism is where we understand communal living, the idea that everybody owns everything.
Yep.
Well, that never happens.
Right.
It always stops at socialism.
Yep. Yep.
The government says, well, you give it all to us, then we'll give it to everybody.
Yep.
But they never give it to anybody.
they hold on to it. Once they're in power.
That's right.
In fact, they even call it the dictatorship of the proletariat. And, of course, the proletariat is working people.
Right.
Oh, wait a second. So, don't worry about the dictator. He's your dictator.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I feel much better now.
Yeah. So there really isn't any communism. So when we call an economy like in Cuba or Russia communist, it's really socialist, right?
Right. And pure socialism. The state owns everything.
State,
that's right.
Now, so tell the story of the pilgrims, because you're really good at this, and it's a really great example.
Well, of course, the pilgrims were flat broke, and they weren't just all separatists. There were some actually members of the Church of England, because some wanted to go to the New World for new opportunities, a new start. And, of course, you had Bradford and that group that was spiritually motivated for much of what they did.
That we call the pilgrims.
Pilgrims, that's right. But they put together a company is really what it was. It was an investment in the New World. Of course, the pilgrims, as the separatists, were pure of heart. They wanted to come over here and really create a new society, civil and religious liberty, reach the Indians with the gospel.
Sure.
But they had to have investors. So they couldn't afford to rent the ship. They couldn't afford all the product they would need for that first year. So it was an investment situation. And their investors required that they build a storehouse, and they hold all things in common until the debt was paid off. Well, those first couple of years, when they discovered, in fact, in Bradford's own writings, which is recorded in
Plymouth Plantation. Now, Bradford. Tell everybody who this is.
William Bradford was actually a young man when the separatist movement in Scrooby, England, got started. And he grew. He was actually under the tutoring of James, Pastor James.
John Robinson.
John Robinson. Thank you. Yeah. I think no one can remember it. And Elder Brewster, Deacon Brewster, and all these. And but of course he grew and wound up after John Carver, who was the first governor, died.
Bradford, early on
that first year. Carver died that first year. Then Bradford was voted governor, and he was governor for better part of the next 40 years.
Oh yeah.
So he was a trusted leader and a man of God, devout.
Yeah.
But he records in his historical account of their time there, which is called Of Plymouth Plantation, that they attempted to enforce those instructions, that they were to live in a commune and have a storehouse. And what they found is the men didn't want to work if they weren't rewarded for their labor. The women didn't want to wash the clothes and feed the men that weren't part of their family. And they found that without incentive to be rewarded for your hard work, even a small group, remember this, less than 100, half of them died that first winter, even with a small group that was this moral, I mean, compare them to us today. It's like not even close.
Pretty spiritually committed, yeah.
Even that moral, this idea of communal living failed. Because when there's no incentive to work hard, who wants to work hard? Yeah.
So a few would go out and work their fingers to the bone, but they would have to provide for all those that just lay around.
And then they'd quit working. Well, of course. Wait a second. I don't get work. This guy's hardly working. I'm working my tail off, and we're getting the same amount of beans at the end of the
day. Why am I going to try hard?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So that system failed completely.
So what did Bradford do? What was his solution?
Wound up giving each of the families, based upon their number, a certain parcel of land. And they did do some work. There was a hybrid that first
career. Of course.
Did some work to try, because they were honorable men. They wanted to pay back that debt, and they did. But everybody also had their own plot of land. And it's amazing how there was no more risk of poverty after that, because everyone was motivated to work.
Well, Bradford basically said, you don't work, you don't eat, basically.
Didn't somebody else say that sometime?
Yeah. What was that?
Was that in the Almanac?
What other religious book?
What was it called?
Let's see. The Writings of Confucius?
Yeah.
Book of Mormon.
That's right. No,
it was the B-I-B-L-E, right?
That's exactly right.
Teachings of Paul.
Exactly right. And that was a biblical truth. If a man can't work because he's injured,
that's where
charity kicks in.
Well, of course, that's different.
But if a person just refuses to work,
that's where laziness kicks in.
Well, you know what? If I work hard and feed a guy that refuses to work, that's called stealing.
Of course it is.
If I choose to give it to him because he's unable, that's charity. But if he just is taking from my work because he refused to work, that's stealing.
Well, and that's why Paul said, if you don't provide for your own house, it's like you've denied the faith and become worse than an infidel, because you'd steal from somebody else's hard work.
So
you're a thief.
Right. That's exactly
right. So how could you be a Christian if you're a thief?
Now, we're going to segue over to what we are here in America.
Okay,
here
sorry.
No, we're doing great, but we can talk about this for an hour.
Well, it probably should.
But go ahead. But the big contrast is this. You got the free market where everybody owns their own stuff. And then you got this desire for the state to own everything. Well, the people that own their own stuff, and maybe that's been in their family for 100 years, they don't want to just give it away. So that's why you have to have a strong police force, a state police force, to encourage you to give your farm to the state when you don't want to. And if you refuse, you might find a bullet in the back of the head.
Oh.
And then when you are going to the coal mines and you are supposed to work 60, 80 hours a week and you don't get paid well for your labor, you don't have motivation to go to the office. Well, that's also where the state police comes in, to give you that little incentive at the point of a bayonet to make sure you get out of bed and go to work and supposedly work hard. One of the famous quotes from a missionary, actually a pastor, Pastor Nelson, when I was in Denver just after the wall fell, he came back and shared a story with the church and said there was an old saying over in Russia that the Russian people said, we pretended to work and they pretended to pay us. that's what it is. So you've got, and as you said, Dan, supposedly, you know, Marx had this idea, whether he really believed it or not, I don't know, but, you know, communism is just communal living where everybody owns everything in common. Nobody owns anything. Everybody works as hard as they can to contribute to the greater good, and then you just use what you need. Well, that never
works. The early church in the book of Acts found they couldn't even do that within the church.
Even within the church, that's exactly right.
It wouldn't work. And then the pilgrims, of course found that out
was the best case
16
study.
Centuries later.
So you've got the socialism, which is state-owned everything, which is in between, but the state that takes the property away, they never go on to the communal living. It's always owned by the state, so that's where
they never give it back.
North Korea, Cuba, Russia, China, that's where it's at. Now, there's what we are here in America. That's where
we're supposed kind of to be.
We're supposed to be the free market.
You're right. So, but we've become something in the middle. So what is that?
That's called fascism.
Now, what is fascism?
Fascism is where you think.
This needs to be
part two.
So let's this and keep on going.
Don't ever talk to us. So you want me to land this plane?
Yeah, let's land it.
Too. All right.
This needs to continue for a second.
All right.
So explain what fascism is, and then we'll begin with that in the next one.
No. You're going to have to tune into the next episode if you want to find out what fascism is.
Well, okay.
And if you don't turn in, then he'll know, and I'll know,
and you won't know.
I'm not talking to him anymore, Dan. You say goodbye.
It's been really great to be with you today, and we're going to hold this secret until next time. So if you want to know what fascism is, you need to tune in next week to Riding
the Storm Out.
And we'll share with you about fascism and how that is really making a difference in America today in a very bad way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for joining us, guys.